This is the Young Farmers Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lusher-Shute. You probably heard by now that there is a serious deal in the works to get USDA and the federal government back open next week. This would effectively end the longest shutdown in U.S. history. Thank you to everyone who took action, and thanks to the USDA employees who have been holding up the fort. This week, we bring you my conversation with Matthew Dillon, Senior Director of Agricultural Policy and Programs at Clif Bar. We talk about the challenges of labeling food for consumers and also why the company decided to make a big investment in organic seed research.
Hi, I'm Greta Zaro, organic farmer at Unadilla Community Farm and co-leader of the Leatherstocking Young Farmers Coalition in New York State. I'm a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition because NYFC provides me with a platform for connecting with fellow beginning farmers in my region. For $35 a year, you can become a member too. As a member, you're part of a community of beginning small family farms following sustainable and fair practices. And you get discounts too, like 10% off high mowing seeds. To join, go to youngfarmers.org.
Okay, so I am ready whenever you are.
So Matthew, if you would, quickly, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, my name is Matthew Dillon, and I'm the Senior Director of Agriculture for Clif Bar & Company.
So what does the Senior Director of Agriculture at Clif Bar & Company do?
Yeah, it's a pretty wide scope. So it includes everything from agricultural policy, being our key lead in Washington, D.C. for agriculture work. Any organization that we would work with on shared policy agenda and alignment, I lead up the team that does that work. The job also includes an agricultural investment fund. It's a way for Clif Bar to invest in our agricultural supply chain such that it continues to expand out the availability and stability of organic ingredients from the U.S., but also expand out the stability and success of our farmers.
How many agricultural products go into Clif Bar's line of products?
You know, when I joined the company 7 years ago, I think we were at about 34 specific crop types that we sourced organically.
And are all of Clif Bar ingredients organic?
No, we source about 78% of our ingredients by volume are organic. There are some crops that we continue to have challenges, like macadamia nuts, for example. Conventional macadamia nuts are hard enough as it is and are quite expensive. Getting it to organic has been a real challenge, but that's why we have this agricultural investment fund, is for us to look at what those challenges are for the growers and figure out ways for us to make investments.
Clif Bar, when it started out, there wasn't such an emphasis on organic. Like, what was the evolution of that move towards sourcing more organic ingredients?
Yeah, you're right. In 2003, they started sourcing organic ingredients, and we've had commitments every year of increasing. Our goal is 80% by 2020. And we didn't do it to market organic. They started sourcing organic and didn't really advertise it much. And even to this day, you know, I think most of our customers don't know how deeply committed we are to organic ingredients and organic research. The belief is that organic is good for the planet and good for rural communities and farmers. And so that's our responsibility as a food company. If we rely on farmers, then what can we do to help those farmers? And we saw organic as one of those options.
You know, Clif Bar making that decision to source organically, what has that done to the market? I imagine a jump in demand just from one company, you know, saying that they're going to make this commitment.
The challenge has always been, as you get to a larger economy of scale, how do you do organic at a large economy of scale? And I think that's what Clif Bar, the positive impact we've had, is we're trying to do organic at an economy of scale and keep doing it right. Many consumer marketing studies show that consumers don't really know the difference between organic and non-GMO. They think when they're buying non-GMO soy or non-GMO strawberries that those crops were grown without atrazine and glyphosate and organophosphates. And that's very far from the truth. And so that consumer confusion has led to, in my opinion, a deterioration in value in the organic marketplace and for the organic farmer. It's one of the reasons that we don't do any kind of verified non-GMO verified products for in our company. We think we need to keep promoting the organic?
You know, just in terms of like the marketing to families and to moms, as I am a mom, you know, I can see that. I feel like I have that awareness of how farm practices can impact a community. But how do you, you know, how do you build that empathy with consumers that are not in that context?
It's definitely a challenge, Lindsay. I mean, I think most consumers, asking them to take more time and learn more than just looking at a label is tough. And that's why I think the marketing sector has become very fond of, I call it the NASCARing of our food. Like, you keep putting on more and more labels and logos to try to represent value, and it looks like a NASCAR. We have to continue to try to educate and awareness. And I think it's a matter of working with retailers, working with media, working with nonprofits to tell the more complex stories in agriculture and to share what farmers are doing right, whether they're conventional or organic, because, you know, there are a lot of great farmers and farming practices on both sides of that. It's a responsibility of food companies, but it's also really a responsibility of our culture and our society. And I just feel we have this kind of food literacy movement that's begun, and we've seen some, I think, strong gains in the last decade in terms of food literacy. And I tend to be optimistic, even though I would say that the majority of consumers are still incredibly confused.
Yeah, and I mean, I just, as a mom and someone who, like, I get asked about organic all the time, right? Because our farm is certified organic, and people know that I work with all kinds of different farmers, and I'm also a mom, so they're like, what do you buy? I think they would love to have just like a very easy, straightforward answer, and I just keep going on and on. And
and they glaze, I know, I'm just like you. You see them, they're really interested and passionate, and then their eyes glaze over because you keep going. You know, the mom thing, one just quick comment there. I have to be critical of the organic sector as a whole, and I include even myself in this. I think that one of the things we did early on is that we marketed ourselves based on what we're not. But you then nurture a customer who's looking for those absence claims as opposed to a customer who's looking at relationships. And we need to be telling a narrative that's more about relationship than about these reductionist absence claims.
So I wanted to talk to you today about seeds, because I know that you have spent much of your career working on the issue of seeds and seed diversity. And that is one of the issues that you've taken a lot of leadership on at Clif Bar. So I wondered if you could just, to begin with, can you give us sort of a sense of like why Clif Bar took interest in seeds?
Yeah, you bet. So Gary Erickson and his wife, Kit Crawford, Gary's founded the company. He and Kit are the primary owners. Kit helped start the foundation. She was really the vision behind the foundation. And she recognized that organic farmers did not really have the seed they needed. And I think the entry to that was the work that we had been doing. I was, you know, the co-founder of Organic Seed Alliance, and Organic Seed Alliance was really the kind of first entity to start to talk about how do you breed for organic systems and how do you get farmers engaged in breeding for their own regional needs. And again, it was one of those things like, well, we know what we don't want. We know organic isn't going to be genetically engineered seeds, but what do we want from seed? And so Seed Matters was launched with this idea that in order to develop organic seed for producers and for traits that consumers appreciated, we needed to change the entire seed system. So the Seed Matters funded graduate students, PhD and master's students in organic plant breeding. We needed to have community and urban gardeners involved. So we started a community resource program to help people start their own seed libraries and do it in a way that the seed would have a high quality from seed saving. We needed policy change, and so we launched a campaign to try to slow down and stop the concentration in the seed industry that was leaving many producers, not only organic, but many producers underserved by a diminishing marketplace.
So what is the difference between organic and conventional seed breeding?
I would say that the way that it's easiest to explain the difference isn't in any specific technology, but it's in priorities and intent. In conventional systems, breeders tend to prioritize things that they they can't easily solve with spray-on solutions. So if you know you have a good spray-on solution for a disease, as a breeder, you probably are not going to prioritize breeding that disease resistance into the crop. Or weed resistance, if you know that you're going to spray your farmers primarily spray herbicide, you're not going to prioritize a carrot, for example, that gets out of the ground really fast with a tall top. So that, for example, is a priority in organic seed breeding that is a different priority from conventional. And the key in organic breeding is you have to breed in the area, in all breeding, you have to breed in the area of intended use. Organic environments, both the soil environment and the above ground environment, are different. More pests, oftentimes, that you don't have spray-on solutions for, different weed pressures. Your nutrients are in your soil differently than when you have anhydrous ammonia that you're kind of spoon-feeding your plants. You have to have an organic systems plants that can really get out there and scavenge better for nutrients and have better nutrient uptake efficiency. So it's just this different set of environments and priorities from conventional, but the techniques are often the same. I know, Lindsay, you work in policy. Policy is a slow process. Plant breeding can be a glacially slow process.
I guess we are policy breeding. Yeah. It's
yeah. I mean, policy, you might take 5 years to get a good policy change. It can take 12 years to get a really good, stable new variety in the marketplace.
I mean, the things you're talking about in terms of traits clearly are things that I would imagine that 50 years ago or thereabouts, those are the traits that seed breeders were looking for, right? Because they were assuming a different type of cultivation. So I imagine that trends clearly have influenced the kind of seeds that are being bred and supported by the university system in particular. Can you just sort of speak to like what has happened with agricultural institutions in their breeding departments over, you know, the agriculture departments, horticulture departments over the last 20 or more years, and sort of why you felt the need to infuse some capital and support for those departments and graduates through Seed Matters?
Well, so, you know, when our land grant universities and our agricultural research stations first started to emerge in the mid to late 1800s, seed research and funding for seed was the largest expenditure in our budget, including in the USDA budget, both collecting seeds, building up a strong seed bank, as well as breeding and regional diversification. The land-grant universities continue to have a very strong breeding programs that released finished varieties for farmers, so almost every land grant had their own wheat breeder. Most universities had sweet corn breeders, because sweet corn was this American crop that, Minnesota had one, and you had them on the West Coast, you had them in the Midwest, you had them on the East Coast. The private sector, when it first started to emerge in the late 19th century, the oldest trade association in the U.S. is the American Seed Trade Association, and the first thing they lobbied for was the end of the government seed programs because they saw them as competition to the private sector, understandably. But the trend became that the private seed sector, when it first started out, was very diversified, it was very regional, and honestly, it was very complementary to the public sector, and the two worked very well together. As American agriculture shifted and it became more about larger economies of scale and smaller crop diversity, bigger farms, the shift in the private sector also changed. But the real shift happened when patenting was allowed, not only patenting on genetically engineered crops, but patenting on classically bred crops and even on traits like heat tolerance or flavor profiles. And the signal that gave to the financial industry was, this is a commodity you can now invest in. You can patent it, you can control it for a longer period of time. And very, very quickly, companies that had never been players in the seed industry moved in because they had a lot of capital. Monsanto, was not a player in the seed industry when I was growing up. DuPont, Dow, Bayer, these were not seed companies. These were chemical or pharmaceutical companies, Novartis, Syngenta. And they came in because of capital and finance with intellectual property. And as they did, those ma-and-pa regional seed companies concentrated. At the same time that was happening, a change had occurred in public funding, and that change is called the Bayh-Dole Act. And it was 1980, same time as patenting was coming in, early 80s. And it said, universities, you need to be doing research that's patentable, that you can make control intellectual property and get royalties for your work. We're going to switch your funding from these kind of general block grants, hatch grants, and we're going to tell you, you need to come up with products that, that you can make money off of. Well, it's hard as a university to make money breeding tomatoes or sweet corn for Minnesota when Minnesota farmers, Wisconsin farmers don't necessarily, you know, it might not be the epicenter for growing those kinds of crops. And so the universities decided to focus where the dollars were, and that was primarily in corn and soy, and that's where universities went. Today, the sad truth is states like Iowa that grow a ton of corn don't even have corn breeders really working on finished corn varieties. They just do background breeding rather than release varieties. So it's been a pretty radical shift that accelerated very, very fast in the 80s and continues today, with some really bright exceptions of a few universities embracing the need to breed for a more diversified regional agricultural economy as they see consumers more interested in those kinds of economies.
That is critical context. And I'm wondering, the organic seed companies, I guess I'm just wondering, like, today, how does the university system fit in with the private landscape of seed companies? And is that different depending on whether a seed company is focused on organic or not?
I would say that the smaller, still independent companies, whether they're organic or conventional, continue to work well with universities. And I think Cornell, for example, has a great relationship with many both conventional and organic seed companies. Companies like High Mowing, they have their own breeders. They work with private farmer breeders. I mean, there's this emerging, incredible network of farmers who are breeding finished, high-quality, uniform varieties for organic systems. And I think there's a desire amongst farmers to try to support those kinds of industries when they can. But of course, at the end of the day, for the farmer, the variety really has to work for their system. There's also a lot of farmers in organic who rely on Monsanto Bayer varieties through their Seminis vegetable line. That's because Seminis has some darn good vegetable seed.
There's, to some degree, just a little bit of a gap of understanding around just the global seed trade.
Yeah, when you buy, I think that's the thing. Consumers, whether they're a farmer or a backyard home gardener, they assume when they're buying seed from catalog, you know, X, that that catalog is breeding, growing, you know, doing it all. And the truth is, many seed companies, most do not breed their own. Many do not even grow their own seed. They hire out and have contract firms that do it, or they buy seed on the wholesale market.
Last year, I guess it was that the Bayer Monsanto merger, or was it
this year?
It was this year. With a consolidation of seed companies, now we have so much of the world's seed supply concentrated in the hands of just really a handful of companies. What sort of risks are inherent with that type of marketplace?
Yeah. Well, I think it's important to back up, Lindsay, and just remember that consolidation in seed is one example. It's really, this is about consolidation of capital. Mm. So consolidation of capital happens when you can consolidate industries. We're talking about finance firms seeing an opportunity to take their concentrated financial capital and take over and own a sector for additional gains. And now data, you know, Monsanto and others trying to buy up farm data by through all these data technology acquisitions they have. So I to me right now, this is probably the most important issue in agriculture, period, is this financial capital that is able to create asymmetry and powers for farmers and rural communities, and that leads not only to fewer choices in the ground on seeds, which can lead to crop epidemics and a narrowing of a genetic base, but it also has major issues on farm economies. Because when I grew up, you know, we raised cattle. You'd go to a cattle auction, and there were many, many buyers at a cattle auction. Today, you go to a cattle auction, and you know, you got JBS, like that. You know, the market for purchasing, slaughter, manufacturing of whether it's pork, cattle, poultry, highly concentrated in the hands of two or three companies in this country. I can't emphasize enough we need to have a deep examination of the disastrous impacts of concentration on farming, on rural communities, and on our climate and our environment. And until we do that, we are going to continue to go down the path of losing more farms, losing more quality of our soil, putting ourselves at more exposure and risk to climate catastrophe in terms of crop genetics. I'll get to answering your question. I'll do it succinctly.
No, I think you're right. It's like you can't isolate the issue of consolidation that's happening with seeds. But you're right. It's like you can't isolate it. It's impact that these seed companies have both for the marketplace, but also just like what happens on the land and the scale that's required. And, you know, the other instances of consolidation that we're seeing nationwide, it's problematic. And, you know, you're absolutely right that farmers are not in a position to really play in that game, right? Like we don't have that type of capital. Or power.
Yeah. The reason I point all that out for one is that I feel like people always want to make Monsanto, now Bayer, the boogeyman. And it's like, you know what? Like, getting so obsessed with the boogeyman, you're missing the forest for this single tree. Like, so, but I will give you a specific example of a challenge with crop genetics, and it's very succinct. Goss's wilt. Goss's wilt is a disease that hits corn. It used to only exist in about 6 counties in the kind of western plains, parts of Wyoming, Colorado, western Nebraska. Goss's wilt started to expand in its geographic range very, very rapidly about 6 years ago. Corn yields in counties that were getting it was down 20-30%. And Goss's wilt was linked back to a specific inbred in corn production. So in hybrid corn production, the inbred male line, it was a Monsanto line, but again, it's not Monsanto that's the problem. It's everything. But it was that they had an inbred line that had susceptibility. And the truth was that maybe there's 30 different corn hybrid varieties by name that farmers were buying in those regions, but they all had that same male parent. And so this susceptibility was there because of that narrowing of genetics and because there weren't enough corn companies making hybrids for farmers. Suddenly the epidemic started to grow. So that's a very recent example of what concentration can do in the field. Corn geneticists at the land-grant universities knew immediately what the problem was. And my email box was filled with these really brilliant, you know, some people like Major Goodman from North Carolina State's been working in corn for 55 years. He's considered one of the, you know, the godfathers of modern corn genetics. And he immediately knew, like, here's the problem. It's all about this inbred line. There are people who know the problem, but you know, oftentimes they have a challenge speaking. Major speaks out because he's so tenured and so old, he doesn't care anymore. But a lot of these young, you know, younger folks at land-grant universities, they're afraid to speak out on these issues. We saw that with dicamba, that when the problems with dicamba contamination and killing crops in farmers' fields, universities had crop scientists who were talking out about it and feeling threatened because they were speaking out on these chemical companies who fund their universities. And it's tough if you're a non-tenured professor to sometimes speak truth to the power of the large firms that are funding your universities.
Well, and I guess that speaks to why the Seed Matters Project is important to have these endowed chairs, I imagine, who, you know, have an alternative source of funding to support some different work and new voices.
Yeah, it's actually one of the reasons we did separate from Seed Matters, the company did the 5 endowed chairs that we're continuing to do. And those will primarily be in plant breeding, but we'll also endow chairs in other forms of research. And that's to really put a stake in the ground and say, this position of, you know, organic grain breeding at Washington State University is here in perpetuity. And it's not about serving just Clif Bar's needs. It's about serving this greater public good. And we need to see more of that from the organic sector. If we spend as much money on ag research as we did, you know, complaining about Monsanto and the we could start surpassing them in a lot of ways.
Policy is going to have to play into solving some of these issues of consolidation. And what do you make of the Farm Bill? Are you pleased? Certainly on the organic research front, there was a success there. Feeling pretty good about the beginning farmer work, but these issues of consolidation are not really dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, every farm bill is a mixed bag, and I think this one is no different. the ongoing challenge is how do we reallocate funding from this subsidy model where we're underwriting crop insurance and really underwriting private crop insurance companies? How do we shift that funding to paying farmers for ecosystem services, for really caring for soil and water and biodiversity on their farm? And I think that is the mandate. And I think we're still a long way away from that. It's somewhat frustrating to me, to be honest, that there's so many companies out right now talking about climate and the food space and regenerative agriculture and climate commitments and all the rest. And yet so few companies who are actually working to try to build a climate smart farm bill, a farm bill that really would pay farmers for ecosystem services. And I think the reason is that, you know, the business as usual helps keep really cheap corn, really cheap soy, and really cheap grains in the marketplace for these food companies. And at the end of the day, I don't think consumers should be confused about what a lot of these food companies really care about. And that's my biggest disappointment, is who showed up for the farm bill on climate.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, it's the kickoff of our next farm bill campaign as a, you know, broad sector. So hopefully we're going to be able to bring some new champions along with the next farm bill and work towards those more significant and difficult shifts. But yeah, I agree. They need to happen.
And I want to end on a good note, because I am so impressed by what National Young Farmers Coalition has done, not only on the federal level, but the state level. And it is incredible, the gains that were made in the federal in the farm bill for beginning farmers and ranchers. And I think it's also incredibly important that we don't just say, okay, farm bill's done, now we can rest for 5 years. I think you all's work on the state level is where our passions need to go, because state level work can help build the federal. So just thank you all and congratulations.
Thank you, Matthew. And yeah, we look forward to continuing to work with Cliff on all the above.
You bet. Thank you, Lindsay.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Matthew. To learn more about Cliff Bar's work on organic seeds, go to seedmatters.org. Thanks to a bunch of listeners who have shared episodes on Instagram this week. Soulfire Farm, Eric Sanarud, Essex Farm Institute, we really appreciate it. If you haven't already, please rate and review us on iTunes. Tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like. We appreciate it all, and we will thank you on next week's show. This episode was recorded at Radio Kingston, and it was edited by Hannah Beal. Hannah gets an extra shout out this week because she has been editing like way too many shutdown episodes. Thank you, Hannah. See you next week.